So good morning, everybody, and welcome back from the winter school. So this will be a cosmology review course, and it will be very elementary course, so basically like an introductory course to cosmology. And if you are interested more to get to know more, then I encourage you to take the explorations in cosmology with Kendrick, and there will be more observationally based, and but also there will be some heavy calculations done. So in my course, basically no calculations. And as Einstein said, you should make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. But I will try to make them simpler than simple. Okay, so really basically no calculations apart from the very end. But I will also skip all the calculations there. So now the question you should be asking is, why you should bother about cosmology? So why cosmology? And there are several answers to this thing, but so let me mention some of them. So for example, very motivating is that it's actually a very rich physics. So what I mean by that is that basically it combines many various disciplines of physics. So it combines statistical physics, thermodynamics, general relativity, quantum field theory, and more recently particle physics. And in fact, actually many particle physicists at the moment, they don't really do particle physics, but they do some kind of cosmology. So it's, you know, if you are a particle physicist or want to study particle physics, it's very good to study cosmology. And this was already mentioned many, many years ago. So Zeldovich, who was this famous Russian physicist. So he said, well, the early universe, is an accelerator for the poor. And so really, you know, why to build very, very expensive accelerators when you have high energy particles coming in cosmic rays, where you have, you know, high energetic events in the universe, and they are so basically for free. Okay, so it is, you know, it combines various traditional areas of physics, but also it opens an arena for studying some more speculative theories like quantum gravity theory or string theory. So basically, you know, that's one of the aims of string theory more recently, is really to find some predictions of string theory, which comes naturally out from string theory, which could be tested, for example, in the early cosmology. Or the same thing for quantum gravity. So another thing is that it's observationally based. And of course, this was not the case all the time in the history. In fact, cosmology started from a cosmological principle, just like, you know, we are not unique in the universe, and so, you know, what we see here, even UFOs have to see, and whatever. So no longer this cosmological principle. But in fact, there is a number of, you know, very, very exact measurements, and there's lots of empirical data, and so now actually it's actually real science. It's not just a theory, but it's something which can be very well experimentally tested. And so based on solid observations. And, you know, and that's the case in the past 20 years, basically. So it's really something which was fast developing in 20 years. And of course, the question is, you know, what will happen once we, you know, start having these gravitational waves observations? Whether maybe they will tell us something more about cosmology as well. So, you know, the question is, it could be a good time to study cosmology because maybe the gravitational wave observations will bring something new about cosmology. Okay. So third reason will be that new physics is likely
to be discovered here.
And so why that is the case is there's lots of problems which, you know, cannot be explained by the present theories. And so you have lack of explanations for various observations, and that's always good. So of course you have probably heard about the cosmological constant problem. So why is it so small? Why is it so big? Why is it exactly what it is, and so on? But there are other problems. So there's, for example, eta problem, which I will mention. So eta is something which measures how many baryons per photons you have. And then it turns out that you have 10 to the power 9 times more photons than baryons. And it tells you something about the original configuration of matter and antimatter, and nobody really understands why this is exactly 10 to 9. There is a lithium problem. So we will talk about Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and it works very well. It predicts the precise number of helium and other elements, but actually the lithium is completely off. And so nobody knows why this is the case, whether the observations of the abundance of lithium in the universe actually are wrong, or whether actually the theory is wrong, or what's going on. So there's another problem, it's called lithium problem. And of course there are these all problems connected with inflation. So I will sort of present inflation as a simplest and nicest explanation for what we see in the universe. But the truth is that actually there's many, many problems with the idea of inflation. And so we will see these in detail. So anyway, so whenever you have some problems and there is some clashes with the theory, it's good, right? Because then it hints on new physics. Finally, I'll mention the final thing is that there are jobs. So that's also good for you. So if you study cosmology, you're likely to find a postdoctoral position, you're likely to find a faculty position, and so on. Much more difficult it is to find a faculty position in quantum gravity than in cosmology or particle physics. Okay, so that's another reason for you to be interested in cosmology. Okay. So now let me mention several of these established facts. So what is really observed? And so to the first approximation, it is observed that the universe is homogeneous and not isotropic. Of course, and up to a certain scale. So of course, on very small scales, you know that it's not homogeneous because it's very different here and it's very different there, right? But this is basically for large scales, so something like hundreds of megaparsecs, but I'll return to this very shortly. So this is for large scales. It's approximately homogeneous and isotropic. Another observation is that it actually expands. And approximately to, according to Hubble's law. That's another observation. We know that it's filled with cosmic microwave background. So it's like radiation of photons which comes at you from all directions in the universe, and it approximately it behaves like black body. So it actually you can assign a temperature to it, and the temperature is approximately 2.73 Kelvin. And so it's very, very, very isotropic radiation. Then you know that about the baryonic composition, baryonic matter. And so basically, the universe is composed of hydrogen and a little bit of lithium, and then there is a tiny little bit of seasoning, which is all the other elements, which are, of course, very important for life and for the Earth and stuff like that. But they are, you know, negligible in the total view. So 75% is hydrogen, and then 25% is helium. and everything else just, you know, tiny bits. But you also know that the baryonic matter is probably not the whole story. And you have things like dark matter and dark energy. And they basically form 95% of the universe. And so nobody knows what they are. So that's why they are called dark. Well, they are dark, but anyway. Like dark powers, Dark Vader. So anyway, so that's, again, a huge puzzle. What these things are, what, you know, and again, new physics is probably likely to emerge here. Finally, you know that, well, despite that it's very, very homogeneous and isotropic, it's not completely homogeneous and isotropic. And there are some fluctuations, so there are small fluctuations. And in fact, the observations point that when the universe was 1,000 times smaller, you know, there were 10 to minus 5, well, several, what is it? Not even person, but it's much, much. So 1 in 10 to minus 5 fluctuations in the density. In density, when universe thousand times smaller. And so we observe these fluctuations in density now in the fluctuations of this cosmic microwave spectrum. And of course, what is speculated, and there's nice theory behind that, is that, you know, these teeny tiny fluctuations, they gave rise to the structure formation. So they are the origin of galaxies and stuff like that. So this leads to structure formation. And that's why somewhere there is galaxy and somewhere there is nothing. Okay? So basically, these are the basic observational facts about the universe. And this is also a roadmap to our course. So in the first week, we will talk about homogeneous universe, which is a very good approximation. Then in the second week, approximately, we'll talk about the matter content. And the last week, we'll talk about fluctuations. Okay. So now I gave you the syllabus, and there are some recommended books. So I'll try to post this PSI study text, hopefully at least in the morning before the lecture. It should be available on the wiki. Also, I would recommend Donaldson, Modern Cosmology, which is like standard, relatively easy to read book. Mukanov's book is a little bit more complicated, but it's also very nice. If you want to punish yourself, read Weinberg. But it's, you know, it's very, very detailed, very, very thorough exposure to cosmology. So yeah, it has everything in it. I also realized that actually Sean Carroll's book, Introduction to General Relativity, which you probably used for your relativity course, has several chapters at the end, which are very, very nice and simple to read. And so I will follow some of them as well. So especially when discussing the fluctuations. So that's also a nice book. And then there are these lecture notes available online by Baumann. And so cosmology is relatively easy to read, and the physics of inflation is more advanced. So if you are more interested in advanced stuff, then read the physics of inflation. And also, you don't have to just, you know, whether it's my lectures, but you can watch online lectures by Latham Boyle, who taught this course many times before me. So it's a slightly different approach, but you know, similar. Okay, questions? No questions? So let me start with chapter one. And that will be the homogeneous universe. Okay. And so I told you that really the universe looks homogeneous on some scales. So let's see what these scales are. So observable universe is something like 3 × 10⁴ megaparsec. So parsec, of course, is 3.6 light years. And so this is, you know, what we see. And so you can talk about homogeneity on large scales. So homogeneity on large scales, which are approximately like 100 megaparsec. Okay, so this homogeneity or isotropy, so really if you average over, you know, these large scales, there's several galaxies, I average over that, and then I see in every direction, I see the universe isotropic, basically, but only on these scales. Okay, so now this is not true for every observer, of course. It's only true for a very, very special observer, which is called commoving observer, is the cosmological fluid. And so you can think about it like, let's say you are swimming in the stream, and of course, if you are swimming against the stream, you don't see isotropic stuff around you, right? Because you are actually pushing against the stream. If you actually flow with the stream, then yes, everything will look the same every direction. So there is a very, very preferred observer, which is the isotropy. So this on large scale observed by, let's say, typical free-falling or better, commoving observer. An observer which is basically commoving with the cosmic fluid, with the galaxies. Once you start accelerating towards your galaxy or whatever, of course you lose this isotropy and whatever. Okay, so now, as we will see, the homogeneity is even much more, the isotropy is much more, the universe is much more isotropic when you look at the CMB. So there really you can see the fluctuation of this 10 to minus 5, but that, other than that, it looks perfect isotropic. So now, important point, which I would like to stress, is that from our point of view, we don't really see homogeneity. What we see is the isotropy. So we see that the universe looks the same, this direction, that direction, that direction. Okay? So what we really see, we see isotropy. And then we accept an additional assumption that actually we don't have any preferred position in the universe. And if we don't have any preferred position in the universe, then the Martians will see exactly the same isotropy as we do. And then other civilization, which is very, very far away from us, will see exactly the same universe as we do. Okay? So we see isotropy, and then assume so-called Copernicus principle, which says that we don't have any preferred position, and so exactly what we see, everybody else will see in the universe. And so from here, it implies that the universe has to be isotropic everywhere. But if it's isotropic everywhere, you can show that there's a mathematical theorem that it also has to be homogeneous. In other words, if I move somewhere else, it'll look exactly the same as we say. Okay, so in some sense, this is what we observe, the isotropy. And then we have to assume that, there's something else which we have to assume. And then we can say, the universe is both isotropic and homogeneous. Okay? And so in this first chapter, we really assume that the universe is isotropic and homogeneous. Okay? What will be first?
Are we also assuming that it's infinite with this?
Well, it doesn't have to be infinite, as we will see.
Okay.
Yeah. So first approximation, universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Okay, and so that's basically this chapter which we'll be doing now. You can abandon that idea and you can say, well, let's study just universes which are isotropic from this point, but they will look slightly different in another point. And then you're, of course, getting much more complicated models. But there's no reason to do that at this point. So let's really assume that the simplest possible thing here. So now, the homogeneous and isotropic spaces, if you want, are described by something which is called maximally symmetric spaces. Describe all homogeneous and isotropic spaces. Okay, so what you expect is that this is something like Euclidean space, maybe anti-Desiter, but also a sphere or hyperboloid and all these things. So all these things are maximally symmetric spaces and they are all homogeneous and isotropic. Okay, so now there is a very nice construction of all these spaces by embedding them into one-dimensional higher space. Okay, so construction of all of these is by embedding so if you want to describe n-dimensional maximally symmetric spaces, then we'll be embedding in n plus 1 dimensional space. Okay, and so before I do a general construction, let me do two examples. So example 1 is just a sphere, so that's something very, very simple. So you want to describe sphere in two dimensions. So you have coordinates x1, x2, and x3. And the radius of the sphere is rho. And so, of course, the sphere is only the surface of this thing. So your star is just the Euclidean metric in your 3 space, which is dx1 square plus dx2 square plus dx3 square. OK. But you know that your sphere is actually not, well, it's defined by a constraint in your 3-dimensional space. And that constraint is precisely that the radius is rho square. And so this is x1 square plus x2 square plus x3 square. Okay, so this is your constraint, if you want, which defines your sphere. And so to obtain the metric on the sphere, you just have to basically differentiate this guy and plug it here. Okay, so if I differentiate this guy here, so this is your constraint. And if I differentiate it, I get 0 on the left-hand side, and then I have x1 dx1 plus x2 dx2 plus x3 dx3. And so what you want to do is solve this for something. So let's solve it for dx3. So from here, we need dx3 square. So dx3 square is just x1 dx1 plus x2 dx2, the whole thing square, and then divided by x3 square. But x3 square is just rho square minus x1 square minus x2 square. Okay? So this is how you solve the constraint. And of course, now you take this expression here, plug it over here, and that's your metric on the sphere. Okay? Well, this is all very, very simple. It's so simple that I will do one more equally simple example. And that will be of a two-sheet hyperboloid. So example two will be two-sheet hyperboloid. Two. And so basically the construction is basically exactly the same, but now you change some of the spatial dimensions here into time dimensions, and also there is a plus sign in front of this rho square, which means that the curvature of the sphere is positive. So now if you want something which has negative curvature, just change the sign and you put minus here. Okay, so this is what you want to describe. So x1 is again this direction, x2 is that direction, x3 is that direction, and we want to describe something like that, and something like that. And so this is the two-sheet hyperboloid, which we want to describe. And so you start, instead of in the Euclidean space, you start with the Minkowski. So Minkowski, so the metric is now ds square is dx1 square plus dx2 square minus dx3 square. So x3 is now my time, if you want. And also, this guy has negative curvature. So the rho is this thing here that measures the tip of the cone. So now there will be this minus sign. Minus rho square is x1 square plus x2 square minus x3 square. So this is your constraint defining your hyperboloid. And again, you can play the same game. So you can differentiate this equation here, solve it for dx3, and plug it here. And that will be your metric on the hyperboloid. OK, so now this was two simple examples. So now let's do equally simple general case. Okay, so in general, and the statement is really that by this construction, you get all these maximally symmetric spaces locally. Okay, so generally, an n-dimensional maximally symmetric space of signature P and Q, some numbers, and curvature K can be either 0 or plus minus 1, is given by the following prescription, which exactly follows these two examples. So it's given by so now you start with something pseudo Euclidean space. So ds square is, so now you take a Minkowski metric eta ab, however, with signature p and q, which means that you have p pluses and q minuses there. So it's a diagonal thing which has plus 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 p times and minus 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 q times. And then you take k, which is this 0 or plus minus 1. Of course, if it's 0, then this is really simple. And then dx n plus 1 square. And you define this to be a new metric, eta ab, p and q and k, dxa, dxb. Of course, I'm missing dxa, dxb. Sorry for all that. And then the thing is given by a constraint that k times rho square is given by the same metric, eta ab, pq, and k. and xA, xB. Okay, so this is your prescription for any maximally symmetric space. And so as I said, this FIAB, P and Q is just plus P times, and then minus Q times, and then K is 0 or plus minus 1. And index small a, b goes from 1 to n. And index big a, b goes 1 to n plus 1. OK. So now it is a dirty trick to define. So here we have coordinates which have index up. So we have dxa, xa, xb, and so on. But you can define xa with index down by lowering with this small eta metric. Okay, so you can define xa to be just eta ab, b and q of xb. And then you can define x square to be xa. And so with this notation, you can actually resolve this thing completely generally. So as we have the metric here, so let's do it now in this general terms. So then my constraint in this notation becomes very simple. So we have k rho square. And then if a and b are just small indices, then you just get x square. And then if they are big indices, then you just get this k, this thing here. So it's plus k x n plus 1 square. So that is your constraint in this notation of small and big indices. Yeah?
Does that mean that for any given signature, there are exactly three?
Not exactly three.
Maximally symmetric.
I'll show you. You'll see in a minute. In some sense, yeah. Well, whatever. You will see. Yeah. So, yeah. Mathematically speaking, yes. Yes. So now you want to differentiate this constraint. So you get 0 is, well, okay, let me write it as I have here. We have k times x n plus 1 dx n plus 1 is equal to minus xa dxa. So now you solve that for dx n plus 1. So dx n plus 1, of course, you want square, is xa dxa. Square. What I mean by that is xa, xb, dxa, dxb using the Einstein summation convention, and then divided by rho square minus k x square. Okay? So this is just differentiating the constraint and evaluating what dxn plus 1 square is. And so now you plug it back, and so you see that your metric is eta AB plus this thing here, or in components, the metric G AB BQ K, which is the most general metric on this maximally symmetric space, is just eta AB B and Q, and then that thing over there, which is plus K X. xA, xB, rho square minus x square, kx square. And so these are the components of the most general maximally symmetric space time. Okay? So it's always simple, right? It's just equally simple as doing the sphere.
We get some differentials.
So these are just the components.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. So I sandwich it with DXA everywhere. Okay. So now this is the metric. And of course, if you have the metric, you want to study some of its properties. And so the most painful, of course, is calculation of the Riemann tensor. I don't want you to do it. Well, maybe I will do. But at this point, I just give you the answer. So then you find that the Riemann tensor RABCD is given by K over rho square, and then G AC G BD minus, you have to respect the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, GAD GBC. So this is how your Riemann tensor looks like. And some people use this as a definition of what a maximally symmetric space means. So if you can show that it's given by a constant times just the symmetries of this thing given by the metric, as the symmetries of the, you have seen this thing in two dimensions, I guess, in relativity course. So this is basically the same thing. So anyway, so this sometimes is used as a definition of maximally symmetric space time. But in our case, it's a consequence. Okay, so now, of course, if I have Riemann, I can contract indices A and C and get the Ricci tensor. And then compare the result with the Einstein equations. Okay, so I have Einstein equations. So in general, you will write them as G AB plus lambda GAB equals to 8 pi PAB. So this is the convention for the cosmological term, if you want. So it's always, well, often put on the left-hand side, it's plus lambda GAB. And this is the Einstein tensor. And so if you calculate the Einstein tensor for this Ricci, you'll find that it's a solution of vacuum Einstein equations. So it's a solution of TAB equal to 0 and lambda given by k times n minus 1, n minus 2, and 2 rho square Einstein equations. So these maximally symmetric spaces solve the Einstein equations. They are solutions provided that you have no matter, but you have cosmological constant given basically by this k thing and depending on this rho. Okay. So they are not only nice, but they are also solutions of Einstein equations, which is definitely nice. Okay, so now to your question, basically yes, for every signature we have three possibilities. So you can have a table where you have, so I'll specify the signature here. And then I'll consider three possibilities, k equal to 0, k equal to plus 1, and k equal to minus 1. So now the simplest case is that you start with Euclidean space, which we did first. So I have n pluses, 0 minuses in my eta. So now if k equals to 0, you just get the standard Euclidean space, En. If k is plus 1, you get the sphere. And if k is minus 1, you get the hyperboloid. Okay, so that's nice. So now sometimes people think, well, what if I do n minus 1 and 1 signature? Then, of course, now I have one time. So this thing will be the Minkowski space. This will be the De Sitter space. And this will be the anti-De Sitter space. So in some sense, you can think about De Sitter space as a sphere in the Minkowski space, if you want, and as a hyperboloid in the Minkowski space. And of course, as a mathematician, you can keep going on. So you can go n minus 2 and 2 and so on. But mathematicians like these spaces because they are nicely symmetric. But for a physicist, this is usually the end of story, because now you have explicitly two times in your metric. And so usually space times, these two times are pathological. So you don't want to have. So end of physics story. So if you are a mathematician, you keep going. But for a physics, you have now two times. Okay. So let me just sketch. So you have seen antidesiter and desiter spaces very briefly in the gravitational physics course. And let me just sketch how they look like in terms of this embedding thing. So if you want to plot DS space, then you know, just exactly following the construction which we have here, you know that you have to have signature n minus 1 and 1, and then you have to have k equal to plus 1. Okay. So in that case, I'll have something like this. I'll have x1. Let me label it like that. x1, x2, and x3. But x2 is precisely the time coordinate in my eta ab. So this is actually something like time. Okay, and then I can sketch the light cone here. And then the desiter space is this surface here. So you live in Minkowski space, where x2 is basically like time. And it's outside of the light cone. So you see that the surface is sort of like time-like. So you have regular Lorentzian metric on this desiter space. So Lorentzian metric, and it has positive curvature. Okay. On the other hand, antidesiter space is precisely the same thing, but you just put it on its side. Okay. So you just take it and put it here. So ADS looks like this thing. So now I have again x1 here, I have x2, which is something like time. And then I have x3, which is this thing here. I have my light cone. And again, it's the surface outside of the light cone. But it's now twisted on its side. Okay, so this is your ADS space. But because it has k equal to minus 1, so if you look at this metric here, so I told you that already the signature of eta AB has one minus in it. It has one time, which we call x2. But also this k is minus 1. So this dx, whatever, 3, is also minus. So in fact, we have two times now. So this x2 here, x2 is something like t2. So now we have two directions, two time directions. One is this one, another is that one. Of course, we are describing this ADS space, which is the surface of this hyperboloid, if you want. So that's the surface. So now, if I, let's say, go around the surface this way, so we can go around that surface that way. So now you are going only in two T2 and T1 directions, right? So I'm going only in this way, but this is my T2, this is my T1. So I'm only going in those directions. I'm not going in a spatial direction, x1. So you are going purely in the time-like direction. So as you circle around this thing, you actually have closed time-like curves. Okay, so this is a closed time-like curve. So you see that even, you know, in this case we have, you know, pathological case where you have two times in the metric effectively, and that causes the fact that if I go around this thing here, I end up in the same, you know, the same. So now how people solve this problem, of course, you know, to have closed time-life curves is a problem because you can kill your grandfather and stuff like that. And so what people do is that they go to a covering space to avoid this. People go to covering space. So what is covering space? Is basically they say, well, I'm happily going this way here, and that at the time when I would arrive at exactly at the same point, I imagine there is another hyperboloid starting again. So I've wrapped the hyperboloid many, many times around. So I say the hyperboloid is still going on, and now a new hyperboloid starts, a new hyperboloid starts, and so on. So I'm you know, twisting it many times around, basically. And then, of course, the time doesn't have closed time-like curve. You're still moving in the time direction in this way, but the time is not ending now. So basically, so wrap the hyperboloid many times. And this is called covering space. And so then you get this nice global ADS where actually, you know, the time direction goes on and on and on. But it's because you imagine there's another hyperboloid, not a hyperboloid. Okay? Anyway, so this is this problematic, very, very problematic ADS space, which string theorists like so much. Right? So it has so many pathologies, but still people like it. Okay? So how much time do we have? We have 15 minutes. Questions to this? So from a cosmology point of view, it's the De Sitter space, which is interesting. From a fundamental physics, if you want point of view, it's the ADS space, which has some nice properties. So now I told you these are all the spaces which are homogeneous and isotropic, but they are called maximally symmetric spaces. So let me just prove to you that really they are maximally symmetric. Means that they have maximal number of symmetries you can ever imagine in the space-time. So question is, why maximally symmetric? And so you know that in GR, symmetries correspond to killing vectors. In other words, I have to have a vector psi which satisfies nabla I psi b plus nabla b psi a equals to 0. So that's your killing vector equation, which defines what a killing vector is. So now the question is, how many killing vectors can we ever have in any space-time? Okay? And so for that, of course, this is a partial differential equation, and it has some integrability conditions. So study integrability condition. Which sounds fancy, but for a physicist, of course, it means that you want to differentiate this equation one more time, and possibly swap the derivatives and see what happens, right? Okay, so that's precisely what you have to do. You differentiate nabla c on this equation, and then you know that in curve space you cannot really swap the derivatives to get zero, because you are that's precisely the definition of the Riemann tensor, right? So you'll be picking up the Riemann tensor if you try to swap the derivatives. And so the integrability condition by doing that is given by, this is in my stupid notation, doesn't matter, so nabla A NABLAB Psi C, and let's see. So it's minus, now there's this remount tensor, and that is BC A D Psi D. Okay, so this is the integrability condition which you get by using the definition of the Riemann tensor and by differentiating this equation and doing some strange things. Okay, cyclic permutations. Okay, so that's the integrability condition for killing vectors. Now this integrability condition has lots of interesting consequences. So one of the consequences, so one of them is, what happens if I contract index A and B here? Okay, so if A and B contracted, well, then on the left-hand side, I just get a box operator, nabla A, nabla A. They have box acting on psi C. And on the right-hand side, you get a Ricci tensor. So this is equal to minus R C D Xi D. Okay, so this is what you get. So now in particular, if you are in vacuum, so the vacuum R A B equals to zero. So box on psi is equal to zero. But you can also look at this equation and you can contract the indices A and B. If you contract the indices A and B, you get twice the same thing. And you get divergence of psi equals to zero for any killing vector. Okay. Anybody recognizes these two equations? If not, then I'll fail you from PSI course.
What
else? Huh? So this thing is something like a Lorentz gauge condition. And this thing is the wave equation for my wave vector psi, right? So in other words, it tells you that in vacuum, any killing vector is a solution of Maxwell equation. So psi solves Maxwell equations. So if you remember the tutorial in gravitational physics, I told you, well, let's consider Schwarzschild spacetime, let's consider dt killing vector, and let's show that it solves Maxwell equations. So now we have the general proof that any killing vector, actually in any spacetime, will solve Maxwell equation. But it's also, but it's only in the vacuum. Well, another trick, yeah?
The vacuum, you also mean lambda equals zero, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, very good. So if you have lambda, then you know that the Einstein equations look like Ricci is proportional to lambda GAB. Okay, so if so lambda, then Ricci proportional to lambda GAB. So then what you are getting from this equation is something like box on, and then something which is proportional to lambda acting on psi equals to zero. Anybody recognizes this equation?
Yeah,
very good. So actually, so now this would still be true. So you would have now massive wave equation, right? So you would have actually massive electromagnetism in the presence of lambda. Of course, if lambda is negative, you would have negative mass, and you have some problems and stuff like that. But yeah, so in this case, this is also interesting case. But in okay, well, let me stop here. So that's first consequence. And so this beautiful, simple consequence of having killing vectors was actually used by Walt, Bob Walt, you probably heard the name, famous relativist in Chicago, to actually talk about black holes immersed in magnetic fields and electromagnetic fields and so on. And he was actually able to really, in these very, very simple terms, construct like real astrophysical black hole, which is surrounded by plasma, which carries some magnetic field and stuff like that. So this is really beautiful. And I encourage you to read his paper. Okay, so that's first consequence of the integrability condition. Let me just talk about the second consequence, which is interesting. So the second consequence is I can, let me do it this way. I can define a new object. So let's say I have this nabla I and nabla A xi b plus nabla B xi A getting vector equation. So in other words, you can show that for Killing vectors, nabla AB is completely antisymmetric. So if I antisymmetrize in A and B indices, I get exactly the same thing, and that's the content of the Killing equation, the symmetric part of this thing, of the covariant derivative finishes. Okay? So now you can denote that by LAB, which is a new tensor, which is completely antisymmetric in index A and B. Okay, so now this is my first equation, and then the second equation will be precisely this integrability condition. So I have nabla A acting on LBC, nabla A acting on LBC is given by minus Riemann tensor VCA d psi d. Okay. So now, if you look at these two equations, they form a complete system of partial differential equations for xi and for L. You can actually solve these equations. So this is a closed system of equations for LAB and xi c. Okay, so we have these two objects, LAB, which is antisymmetric, and then xi. And so these are first order partial differential equations. And of course, there is a theorem saying, well, I can always find a solution, provided I have some initial data. Right? So provided I specify what LAB is at one point and what xi is at that point, then I can find what these AB and xi are everywhere else. Okay, so that's the system, basically. Okay, so that means that to solve this, enough to specify LAB and xi c at one point. And then by solving these equations, I can find LAB and xi c at any other point in the manifold. For example, by parallel transport along any curve or whatever. Okay, so now how many of these initial data are there? So we know that indeed in n dimensions, there is n of those. So it's n. And then this is completely antisymmetric. So in n dimensions, there is n over 2. Combinatoric number, which is n times n plus 1 over 2 initial data. So now what I'm saying is this is precisely the maximum number of Killing vectors you can ever have in any space-time, right? So it's a maximum number of Killing vectors, killings in any space-time. So in four dimensions, it's 10. And so you know that the Minkowski space has 10 Killing vectors. Yes, four translations, and then six Lorentz transformations. Okay, so this must be true. So for example, the Minkowski space has the maximum number. Now we can explicitly construct all these Killing vectors for all these maximally symmetric spaces. It's a beautiful construction. You can find it in Weinberg, but I'm not going to do it here. But I encourage you, if you are interested, really how this maximum number of Killing vectors is constructed for these maximally symmetric spacetime. Okay, so as the maximum number is this thing here, but let's say I don't have maximally symmetric spacetime. Let's say I have Kerr spacetime, or I have any other spacetime. So how do I find how many Killing vectors this spacetime has? Right? Of course, solving that partial differential equation for Killing vectors is usually very, very difficult. So the question is, you know, is there a very fast way how to find, well, there's maybe only two Killing vectors, or maybe there's three, or whatever, right? And so this is the maximal number, but for a given spacetime, for example, the Kerr geometry, to find a number of Killing vectors, there is a theory which is called method of prolongation, which sounds fancy again, but again, what it means is just take a covariant derivative, antisymmetrize, use the definition of the Riemann tensor, and see what happens. Okay, so now if I look at this thing here, for example, I differentiate this equation once more, so I'll do nabla e acting on this thing. And so then I'll have nabla and nabla, and I antisymmetrize in them. So this thing will turn into Riemann times L. Okay, so we'll have Riemann connected with L if I differentiate that equation. On the right-hand side, I'll have something like, which is like nabla acting on R, construct this with xi. And then, of course, I have to differentiate also xi. So I'll have another term, which will be plus Riemann constructed with nabla on xi. Okay, but nabla on xi is given by my first equation, and it's given by L. Okay, so very, very schematically, when I differentiate the second equation once and use this antisymmetrization, I get schematic equation like this. So now for a given spacetime, of course, you know what the Riemann tensor I know, and you know what its derivative is. Okay, so you can really calculate this very explicitly on your computer, what R and what double R is. And then this is an algebraic equation for xi and L. So get an algebraic equation for xi and L. So now you can put there, you know, compute the general xi and compute the general L, and you can try to solve this algebraic equation. And in general, this will be a very, very restrictive equation. And it will kill lots of components of xi and lots of components of L. And so maybe you'll find that in Kerr spacetime, it already kills 8 Killing vectors. And you will see that there are maybe only 2 Killing vectors. If it doesn't, then you have to repeat the same thing. So now you take this equation, differentiate it again. Okay. Again, so now you'll have 2 derivatives of R somewhere. But you can always trade derivative of L by that equation to something which is proportional to xi, and derivative of xi, which is proportional to L. So you get, again, an algebraic equation. And again, you can solve this algebraic equation, and it will kill other components of Killing vectors. So there's a very, you know, this very algorithmic procedure how to find in very, very few steps how many Killing vectors are there in your spacetime. OK. So it's just a consequence of integrability condition. Let me stop here. And tomorrow we will use these maximally symmetric spaces to construct the spacetime which describes our universe.